Okay, thanks, Nicholas. I've been here at KITP now for about 5 weeks, and it's been a really wonderful time to be here, so I just want to thank the organizers for that. And now today I'm going to talk to you about some of the work I've been doing over the last 2 years that I've been at NYU, which has to do with the evolution of gene regulation. And I'm going to be talking today mostly about gene regulation mediated by microRNAs, which we've already heard about a couple times in this workshop. At the end of the talk, if we have time, I'm also going to say a few words about transcriptional regulation, which I'm also interested in. And now, macro and microevolution, so I should explain to you what I mean by that. Now, we're used to thinking about evolution over fairly moderate distances, such as between human and mouse, or sometimes between two different species of Drosophila. I'm actually interested in evolution at the extremes of animal evolution. So at one extreme, we have what I call macroevolution, which is evolution over very large evolutionary distances, such as between a Drosophila and a mouse. And this picture here on the left is a picture of the Hox genes, which we've already talked about a couple times in this workshop. I think Eric Davidson discussed this. And this is just to point out that there really are non-trivial things which you can say about the evolution of gene regulation across these very large evolutionary distances. Now, at the other end of the spectrum, I'm interested in microevolution, which I refer to as interspecies polymorphism, or even polymorphism within a specific population of the species. Here is the species where I'm most interested in, which is our own species. And this is the African population, and you see here that actually there really is a lot of genetic diversity within even subpopulations of the species, even for relatively non-polymorphic species such as our own. Now, it is true that actually the African population is the genetically most diverse population among humans, but you can also observe similar genetic differences in this population and also in this population. And I just, at this point, would like to take this opportunity to acknowledge the two people who have been supporting my work at NYU, Nicholas Rajewski and Fabio Piano. Okay, so we've already... okay, before we get to microRNAs, here's another view of animal developmental regulatory networks and the evolution of this, again, across these very large evolutionary scales. We've heard this once from Eric Davidson, but I like this very much, so I would just like to go through this very briefly again. We think about animal developmental regulatory networks as being decomposed into different subnetworks, which have different functions and different evolutionary behavior. So right at the core of these developmental networks are what Davidson refers to as kernels. And these are things which are recursively wired, and they're generally very small subnetworks, but they're very well conserved across very large evolutionary distances. And he thinks of changes in these kernels as being as corresponding to changes at phylum level characters, so like between Drosophila and mouse, for instance. In the middle, we have evolution of these plug-in and I/O switches that are called in this model. Plug-ins would be something like a signal transduction pathway, like the notch signaling or the MAP kinase signaling pathway. I/O switches would be something like a Hox gene, which would allow or disallow a certain regulatory program in a certain part of the body plan. And these sorts of things we think of as corresponding to class or order or family characters. And then at the periphery of these developmental networks, so this corresponds most closely to the microevolution that I'm talking about, we have alterations of differentiation gene batteries and changes in these kinds of subnetworks typically, at least within this scheme, correspond to speciation events. Okay, so we've already talked about microRNAs a few times in this workshop, but let me just go over this one more time in one slide, just so we're speaking the same language here. In animals, microRNA genes are transcribed by Pol2 promoters from intergenic regions, or they're spliced out of introns of protein-coding genes. This precursor form folds up nicely into an approximate hairpin of about 100 nucleotides. And embedded within this hairpin, there's this mature microRNA, which is about 22 nucleotides long, colored here in red. The mature microRNA is spliced out, and it binds to the 3' end, the 3' UTR of this mRNA. And by imperfect base pairing, by somewhat unknown, unclear mechanisms, either induces a translational block or it degrades the mRNA. And over here is the object which I'm going to be most concerned with in this talk, which is variously referred to as the nucleus or the seed region of the mature microRNA. This is variously defined in the literature as the first 6 to 8 bases at the 5' end of the mature microRNA, and it's believed from both experimental and computational work that the nucleus or seed mediates the most important aspect of binding between the mature microRNA and the mRNA. Now, this seed model has been very influential in the last couple of years in predicting microRNA targets computationally. However, it's known that it's neither necessary nor sufficient for microRNA binding. It's not sufficient because we do know of many instances where there is a seed in the mRNA sequence, but microRNA regulation is not conferred. And it's not necessary because we do know of cases where the mRNA is regulated, but the seed sequence doesn't appear. So there are other mechanisms at work here. However, this target prediction model seems to be the dominant player and has been the most influential in predicting microRNA target sites. We've also heard about microRNA target prediction from a couple of other talks, but let me just go over that because it's going to be important for this talk. I'll go over this once in one slide. So here again is the mature microRNA, and here colored in red now is the seed sequence, which in this slide I've defined as positions 2 to 8 of the mature microRNA from the 5' end of the mature microRNA. Over here, these colored bubbles are just a schematic to show you that this microRNA is not just floating around freely in space, but it's really part of this large complex of proteins and RNAs. This is called the RISC complex, and together this complex mediates gene regulation. Over here, I've shown you an alignment of 3' UTRs from 3 closely related species. And typically what one does is to just look for exact Watson-Crick base pairing between a portion of the 3' UTR and this seed sequence over here. And by Watson-Crick base pairing, I mean that, for instance, GU base pairings are not allowed. So all the base pairings here are G's to C's or T's to A's. And in this particular 3' UTR, you see that there are actually 2 sites here, 2 conserved sites. Okay, so this is not actually the state-of-the-art microRNA target prediction algorithm. And for that, you can Google for one of these 3 things. PICTAR or TargetScan-S are collections of predicted microRNA target sites. TARBASE, which is a database from Artemis Hatzigiorgiou's lab, is a collection of experimentally verified microRNA targets. But this very, very simple, basic algorithm which I've outlined here will get you, say, 80% of the way there. Okay, and that's these are the target predictions which I'm going to talk about here. Okay, so here are just some numbers of what you would get if you would run this target prediction algorithm. I call these perfect microRNA sites because, as I said before, there are also other sites which do not conform to this nucleus model. Those are called imperfect sites. So for the purposes of this talk, we'll only talk about perfect microRNA sites. If you would go and run this algorithm using alignments of these 5 species, human, chimp, mouse, rat, and dog, you would get 22,000 conserved microRNA sites. Okay, so that's on average one site per gene in the genome, but it doesn't mean that every gene is being regulated by microRNAs because the distribution is quite uneven. And there are some genes which, for instance, have very short 3' UTRs, ribosomal genes, for instance, and those we believe do not have a lot of microRNA regulation. And then there are tons of genes which have very long 3' UTRs and they're just loaded with sites. So developmentally important genes or transcription factors, for instance, would be in that class. You can only run this algorithm, obviously, for microRNAs which are conserved in these five species. We believe that there are about 63 microRNAs which fall into that class. So these are 22,000 sites for 63 microRNAs. And the estimated false positive rate of these predictions is 50%. And I'll talk a little bit more about that in the next slide. So, but let me just say that you can also just not require conservation at all and look for non-conserved microRNA sites. Now you're not restricted to just looking at these 63 conserved microRNAs, but you can look at all the microRNAs in the database. At the time we did this, there were 328 human microRNAs, should say human. And now this number refers to all the microRNA sites, so just any site complementary to the seed, which is in humans, but not conserved in these five mammals. So just subtract these 22,000 sites. So now, an important point about this is that non-conservation here is operationally defined based on the alignment. So if the alignment screws up and things are really evolutionarily conserved, but the alignment does not get them, does not align them exactly right, then we consider them non-conserved sites. And I'll get to that later on in the talk as well. So this is an operational definition. So now, obviously this is a humongous number, 600,000, and we expect most of these to be false positives, and most of them are false positives for pretty stupid reasons. For instance, the microRNA and the mRNA are not even expressed in the same tissue or the same cell type or the same developmental time point. And so the microRNA cannot regulate the mRNA, even though it could in, say, an in vitro system. So what we've done here is to reduce this set of 600,000 sites down to a much smaller set of 12,000 sites, which we call co-expressed sites. And we define this by using expression data for microRNAs. So at the time we did this, we had pretty good expression data for 31 human microRNAs, and we knew which tissues they were expressed in. And we also had expression data for a lot of mRNAs. And so we reduced this set of 626,000 down to just those which are in mRNAs, which are expressed in the same tissue as the microRNA. Okay, so now getting back to the 50% estimate, which I gave you before. So this is the standard argument for why this should be the false positive rate. So you go around and you predict sites for your real microRNAs, and you have 22,000 of them, like I said before. Now what you do is you take random control sequences and you predict binding sites for those in exactly the same way. Okay, now you take these random control sequences are chosen so that they match exactly the frequency of the real microRNA sites in the human genome. Okay, now if you assume that these random sequences are indeed non-functional, then this gives you the background rate of conservation. Conservation, of course, in these species does not automatically mean that the sequence is functional. It could also just have not have had enough time to diverge. Or it could be a sequence with a low mutation rate, for instance. Okay, but if you believe that these random sequences are non-functional, then the number of random sequences which are actually conserved in your alignments gives you the background rate, and your signal-to-noise ratio is just the number of conserved microRNA sites divided by the number of conserved control sites. In the previous example, you would get 22,000 microRNA sites, 11,000 control sites. Your signal-to-noise ratio is 2:1, which gives you a false positive rate of 50%. So this argument has a number of problems with it. The most obvious one is that it only works for conserved sites. So if you notice back here in the previous slide, I gave you a 50% false positive rate for these sites, but no false positive rates for these classes of sites. And that's because the argument simply doesn't work. And so some of what I'll be discussing later on will be trying to address this problem. Okay, so I said you can go around and predict sites for microRNAs, but you can also just do this for any 7-mer you like. So you can take a 7-mer, you can go look for the number of instances that appears in the human genome, and you can also look at the number of conserved instances in your alignments. And this defines a conservation score. Okay? And if you look at the distribution of the conservation scores for all the 7-mers possible, so there are 4 to the 7 possible 7-mers, about 16,000, you see that it has this very nice sort of binomial distribution. And now you see that here colored in red, this is data from a paper from Xie et al. From Malos Kellis and Eric Lander's labs. You see that there are these motifs colored in red over here, which have unusually high conservation score, and that they lie in the extremes of this distribution. And here's an example of one of the most extremely conserved motif, which is actually corresponds to this poly-A binding site. And the result of this paper is that many of the highly conserved motifs in 3' UTRs, many of these things colored in red over here, actually correspond to microRNA binding sites. Okay, so inspired by this, the first thing we did was to extend these results from just looking at vertebrate alignments to also looking at Drosophila alignments and to look at C. elegans, nematode alignments. And we covered similar results. So before I get to those, I should tell you what these alignments are. For the vertebrates, we aligned human, mouse, rat, and dog. Drosophila, these 4 Drosophila species, and for the nematodes, these 3 nematode species, elegans, Briggsii, and Ramani. And we looked in this analysis only at 7 nucleotide motifs. So the Xie et al. Analysis looked at slightly larger motifs as well. But here we were concerned specifically with microRNA binding sites, which is why we confined our attention to 7 nucleotides. And now, probably the most interesting thing that comes out of this is when we compare motif conservation across clades. So now, here's the first part of this talk where we're actually looking at macroevolution. So what I've plotted here on the x-axis is the z-score. So this is the z-score in the binomial distribution of each motif in the vertebrate clade, and on the y-axis in the fly or Drosophila clade. So every point here represents a motif, one of the 16,000 7-mers. You see, first of all, that there are a lot of motifs which are highly conserved in both vertebrates and flies, which is already surprising that there would exist such motifs at all. And here, colored in red, we've colored the microRNAs which are conserved in both vertebrates and flies. And now you see two things. First of all the microRNAs which are conserved in these two clades, virtually all of them lie in the significant regime in either one of these two clades. But also you see that all these points over here out in the significant region are all covered by the microRNAs. So we take this to mean that if you look at exact 7-mers and you look at 7-mer conservation in 3' UTRs, these things are very highly enriched in microRNAs, even when you look across these very highly diverged clades. Here's that point again, just to make that point again. Now what we've done is to scramble the assignments of motif scores and microRNAs, and now you see, because these are two independent distributions now, that there's nothing in this doubly significant regime, and all the microRNAs are down into the insignificant regime. Okay, so we can do this as well for the other pairs of clades, and we can do this as well for the three clade comparison. That's a little tougher to draw and display as a scatter plot, but here are the numbers. So in each clade, we saw about 200 highly conserved motifs. So these are things with z-score greater than 3 in the distribution. Of those, depending on the clade, it was about 20 to 30% matching microRNAs. So these are microRNA binding sites. When you look at the motifs which are conserved and are highly conserved in pairs of clades, now you're down to 30 highly conserved motifs, but the enrichment is really high. So it's like 50 to 65% of those match microRNAs. And now when you look across all three clades, you're down to 10 highly conserved motifs, but 80% of those, so 8 of these motifs actually do match microRNAs. Some of our favorite conserved microRNAs, LUT7 and MUR1, are represented among these 10. So what are these other motifs doing? That's a really interesting question, which we're interested in looking at, and that's ongoing work. But a strong hypothesis would be that a lot of these are actually microRNA motifs, which just have not been for microRNAs, which just haven't been found yet. Okay, so all of this was about the conservation of microRNA genes. So based on that, we wanted to look at whether their targets are also conserved, right? So we have these conserved microRNAs. We know that they're important. A lot of them are important in different clades in that their motif conservation scores are very high. So do they actually target the same genes? And we had already microRNA target predictions from this PICTAR algorithm for these three different clades, the vertebrates, the flies, and the nematodes. So we wanted to look at whether those the targets of the conserved microRNAs were conserved. This turned out to be a somewhat non-trivial analysis because the paralog and ortholog assignments are somewhat tricky to do. But here I'm showing you that it's not a stupid thing, at least, to go and try to look for these deeply conserved targets, because there are examples of these things in the literature which are well known. So for example, in animals, there's the famous microRNA LUT7, which is known to target these three genes, LIN41, LIN28, and LUT60. I'm giving you the C. elegans names because these are that's the organism in which these regulatory relationships were first discovered. And all of these regulatory relationships have been since discovered as well in mammals. So these are all examples of deeply conserved targets. There are also lots of deeply conserved targets found in plants between, say, Arabidopsis and moss, which is an evolutionary distance somewhat comparable to between humans and C. elegans. It's about 500 million years. So there do exist lots of deeply conserved targets. And we wanted to see whether we could find more of these. The quick answer is that we found, by doing this paralog and ortholog analysis, that the conservation of microRNA targets across clades is very low. So liberally, we'd say 11% of the targets would be conserved, but slightly higher than expected at random, okay, which would be, say, 5%. Yeah?
So you mean conserved by that it's exactly the same motif that is in other species?
No, so what I mean by microRNA target conservation in this case is that, the microRNA genes are exactly conserved in that they have the same motif, but we want to see whether that gene regulates the same target gene in those two clades. The same target gene meaning the homologous protein coding gene.
And how do you decide that? So we find motifs there?
Yes, so we have to look for conserved motifs for the same microRNA in both the 3' UTRs of, say, C. elegans LIN28 and vertebrate LIN28.
Yeah, okay, and then you use PICTAR predictions on those?
Yes, so for this we use PICTAR predictions, right.
Okay.
So it works at the level of the genes itself. So your target can move around within the same gene.
So the position of the target
doesn't have to be conserved.
What if you have more than one target?
It doesn't matter. So long as you have at least one.
Okay, so you just ask for what the target function is.
Right, so just so long as you have that same relationship, microRNA targets this gene. Right, so it's not at the sequence level, but at the network level. Yeah? Sorry.
I puzzled, like, how come that the nucleus is so well conserved over such a long time? Because it seems that the only thing which matters behaviorally is just to have a complementary or somewhat complementary binding in the nucleus. And so, do you have any vision of why evolution never
plays with the nucleus?
Because it seems that it's so easy to co-evolve nucleus and, well, maybe not so easy because there are so many targets, but.
Right, so that's that's one possibility, is that the microRNA is binding to many protein coding genes, and that if you would mess around with the nucleus, then you would have this very pleiotropic phenotype and would mess with a lot of genes. And so you have a lot of pressure to keep the nucleus. That'd be the most obvious.
It means that there should be a correlation between the, there are probably also examples where nucleus is not perfectly conserved, but somewhat homologous. And then the prediction would be that those microRNAs would have relatively few targets, so there could be a correlation of the nucleus and the targets. Say, if you have maybe four or five targets overall, then
right. You
could imagine that it co-evolves.
That's true, but let me think about that. So. First, we don't see that. So most microRNAs have a lot of targets, so in the range of 200 targets. so you imagine that there might be microRNAs which have, let me see if I'm trying to understand, like fuzzy binding?
Rather than just the number of targets in the overall the genome is relatively few, a handful, I mean five.
Right.
Maybe it just doesn't exist.
Yeah, so I think those could exist. They just don't show up in our analysis, because I think our analysis is focused on is biased to the ones which have this exact complementary. Yeah.
So it looks like you have targets, conserved targets,
mm-hmm.
but the position doesn't matter for the nucleus.
No.
What is really the distance between the two targets in the different. Is that randomly or the
difference between the actual binding sites?
Yes. Exactly.
Yeah. So we can't actually align these sequences over these large evolutionary distances. We tried, but it's just not possible to align these 3' UTRs between, say, Drosophila and humans. So that's not answerable, unfortunately. Okay. Yeah. So we haven't looked at that within clades, what the position of the binding site is relative to the start. Yeah. So we haven't looked at that. Yeah. This is, yeah.
So from this conservation analysis, do you have a picture how this underlying sequence evolution is of these targets? Maybe if getting to that,
but
should I imagine that more or less sort of in most cases the site is approximately conserved in prediction? Or is it that it wildly jumps and new target pops plays and
Yeah, so we don't know, actually, because we can't actually align over these huge distances. The only thing which is actually concerned over these large distances, like between humans and Drosophila, is really this network level property. So at the sequence level, we just don't know. Yeah?
Could you in the spaceship have a train looking for consideration about paralogs instead of orthologs? Because you could find paralogous genes which are relatively recent duplicates of each other, and you predict that if, you know, that this binding between biparadigm and the PR of paralogous genes would decay this science of modification.
Yeah, so for this analysis, we just got rid of all the paralogs, actually. So we didn't do that. But yeah, we could. Might be an interesting thing to check. So if, in other words, we were as liberal as possible. So if it was conserved in at least one paralog, then we were happy and we said the microRNA still targets that gene, at least for this analysis.
And
the
known pair of microRNA and the targets in this nucleus region, they never end wobble in that place there?
There are some cases known experimentally where there are wobble base pairs, but it's believed that the majority of targets, possibly almost all of them, have this exact complementarity. So we're focusing on this largest class of sites. Sorry, the microRNA what? Sorry, I just didn't hear the question.
The ratio of number of targets for microRNA and the mock of the
mock. The mock, okay, right.
So this number varies quite a lot from microRNA to microRNA.
Right.
Could there be any relation between this ratio, the very good ratios with very concerned microRNA sequence of microRNA, something like that?
Yeah, I think there could be. So that's one something we should.
Once your number of functional targets exceeds, I don't know, hundreds, then it's simply impossible to mutate. So in some sense, you can expect this correlation only to work on the low end of.
Yes, that would be one, the most obvious hypothesis, yeah. Okay, so so what we saw is that we, even with the most liberal definition possible of orthologs and paralogs, we still see that the conservation of microRNA targets is very low. It could be slightly higher than random, but it's not really significant. However, when you actually look at what genes what these targets are that are conserved, we actually saw that the conserved targets are actually enriched in genes important in development. So for this, we did GoTerm analysis. And this is just a hypergeometric p-value. So this kind of fits in nicely with the Davidson model of kernels. So the first thing we asked ourselves, because we saw this very low low conservation of targets, was could it just be that the target prediction algorithms are bad? And there's two ways in which you can have bad target predictions. One is to have false positives, one is to have false negatives. So here's a quick argument for why I don't think that either of these two things really affects the entire story. So with false positives, you would expect these false positive things to not be conserved between the two clades. However, if you believe the argument before that the false positive rate is about 50%, then you can calculate that the expected inflation and conservation rate caused by these false positives would be at most a factor of 2. So instead of 10% conservation rate, which is low, you would have, say, a 20% conservation rate, which would still be low. Now, if you have false negatives, that's still not going to affect this rate, right? Assuming that the targets which you don't pick up in your target prediction algorithm have the same conservation rate across the two clades as the ones which you have detected. In fact, I don't think that these two rates are the same. Actually, I think the ones which we haven't detected yet are probably less conserved than the ones which we have right now, and that's because of the way we run the algorithm. We're looking for really well-conserved things. And so, if anything, the conservation rate is conservative here. So I don't think that either of these two things really bias the story. And so we are really, I think, confronted with a situation where we have high conservation of the microRNA genes themselves, but very divergent target sets. And then even within this model, I can imagine two evolutionary models, and inspired a little bit by Eugene Koonin's talk, I call this targets late and targets early, the two evolutionary models. So targets late is that the last common ancestor, which had the conserved microRNA of these two distinct clades, had very few targets. And then separately in the two different lineages, those two clades have subsequently acquired a lot of targets. And so it looks like there's no conservation, but actually they've been independently gained along the two different lineages. That's targets late. And then targets early is the other possible model, in which the ancestor really had a lot of targets, let's say hundreds of targets. And then these targets have just been lost, and other ones have been gained over millions of years. And so now you really see low conservation of the targets in the extant species. And we don't really have a lot of, we don't really have enough data, I think, to be able to distinguish between these two scenarios, although I personally am biased towards targets early, and I think that with greater sampling of species, we might be able to answer this.
Right.
So that would be targets early, more or less. Many of these have been lost and others have been gained. Okay, so that should have been. Yeah, sorry. Yeah.
Actually, targets late model means that in the common ancestors there were really just a few targets, and this coevolutionary argument would be a good argument against this scenario, right? Then you don't expect that in different lineages you would end up with exactly the same nucleus.
That's true, actually.
But again, it only works for a very small number of targets.
That's probably a good argument, yeah.
I think it's very hard to tell from these very divergent things, but when you compare more close things,
right,
then it's probably more viable to about the things that we know. They think about
right,
something which is just far enough that maybe the turnover was 10%, and then...
Right. Okay, so we have done that for Drosophila in particular, and targets early is what's going on there. Exactly what you said, so things are coming and going. Right, so like I said, I'm biased towards targets early, both of these are good arguments, but I don't think we have enough data as it is between these three clades to completely get rid of targets late. Okay, so just to summarize this first part of the talk, let me see. Okay. So if either targets early or targets late is the correct model, it does look like the microRNA regulatory network has undergone extensive rewiring during metazoan evolution. Now, this is not our work. This is actually the work of Kevin Peterson's lab. But they've actually done some nice work in the last year showing that There actually are a lot of new microRNAs which have been gained during the diversification of metazoans. So both of these sort of speak towards the impact of microRNA evolution on phenotypic evolution in metazoans. However, we do think that there's possibly a small set of deeply conserved microRNA regulatory relationships. There are at least the experimental ones, you know, which I showed before, and possibly a few others, although that's not a significant result. And so this ties in sort of with the kernel idea. And then here are just some references for these results. So here's our own paper, which is coming out right now. Some of these things were already discussed in a paper of Dominic's in 2005, and then similar results were also gotten by Saeed Tabazoi's lab in 2005. I think there's actually another author here. I forgot to put it in, sorry. Okay, so that's the first part of the talk, and that was it for macro evolution. And I'm going to switch gears completely and talk about variation in microRNA gene regulation, but now at the microevolutionary scale, and particularly just in humans. Okay, so this is going to be focused almost completely on evolution at the cis-regulatory sites. You can also try to look at intra-specific variation at the transfactor level. But consistent with the story before about how the transfactors are very well conserved, we simply do not see any polymorphism, at least with the polymorphism data we have right now, at the transfactor level in microRNA genes. Simply no SNPs, or SNPs are single nucleotide polymorphisms in these genes. But we can look, and there is a lot of variation, at the cis-regulatory level. And just to motivate this, I can think of three reasons why you would want to look at this kind of polymorphism. The first one is a sort of medical reason, sort of an obvious thing, which is that polymorphisms in these cis-regulatory elements can affect gene expression between different humans, and these can affect phenotypic traits, which could be medically important. The same thing could happen in crop or animal species, which are agriculturally important. And here are just some very nice examples from the literature of experimental results having to do with this. This paper shows a SNP which is connected to Tourette syndrome in humans. A very, very recent paper from David Bartel's lab connects a specific kind of human cancer to a polymorphism in, well, not a polymorphism, but actually a deletion in the microRNA binding site. And here's one in sheep.
What microRNA? The second one is in cancer?
I think it's LUT7. So that's the first reason, which is medical. The second one is more bioinformatic. And if you think about how we use divergence data across species to predict cis-regulatory sites, in a similar way, one can hope to use divergence between individuals in the same population to improve your computational predictions of cis-regulatory sites. And the third one is a more evolutionary reason. And if you think back to the work of King and Wilson back in the 70s, there was a large discussion back then, and I guess still continues today, about how much regulatory evolution plays in speciation and phenotypic evolution versus evolution at the protein coding level. And so studying cis-regulatory polymorphisms could possibly shed light on this question. Okay, so here's the data which we're going to be using. It comes mostly from these two large genotyping projects, the HapMap project and the PearlGen project. Both of these looked at three large populations. Yorubans are an African tribe from Nigeria, and then Asians and Europeans. And HapMap project genotyped a lot of SNPs, 3.8 million SNPs. The PearlGen project looked at a fewer number of individuals and also a fewer number of SNPs, but their data has some nice properties which we'll make use of later on. We take all of these SNPs and we put them together, map them to 3' UTRs in humans, and we find that there are 25,000 SNPs in 3' UTRs from these data sets. 20,000 is roughly the number of protein coding genes in humans. So you can think roughly of there being one SNP in a 3' UTR on average. And this here, a total of 11 million SNPs in the human genome at 1% minor allele frequency, is just to say that this number of SNPs which have been genotyped is a significant fraction of everything that's out there already, that's possible to find. So the first thing that one can do with this SNP data is just to map them down into microRNA binding sites. So now we're using the 22,000 binding sites, which we predicted earlier, just based on the simple target prediction algorithm. We managed to get 384 SNPs total into these binding sites, which is not a lot, but it's enough to do statistics with. And what you can, the first thing you can see with this data is that if you look along the position in the binding site, so here's averaged over all the binding sites, 22 nucleotides long, you see that the fraction of SNPs in the first eight bases, which I refer to as the seed, or the most important part of microRNA binding specificity, is much lower than over here in the rest of the binding site. Now, it's slightly circular because we use conservation in this region of the binding site to predict the sites in the first place. So here, what we have on this is the control, where we again use conservation to predict binding sites, but now we've chosen random control sequences instead of real microRNA binding sites, real microRNAs. And you see that there is a small dip here, but it's very insignificant compared to this very big one. So this SNP analysis speaks to the veracity, first of all, of the binding sites, and also to their importance in evolution.
But somehow, it seems that the kernel weights often show that it's
well, perfect.
That's
it's not more conserved? It's so,
no,
it looks like...
than random. I compare, you know, the actual conserved microRNA the science and the
random. Oh, so... No, so they are. So this is misleading. You're comparing 0.03 to 0.04. That's what you're. So this is a fraction of the total number of sites, which total number of SNPs which fell in here. So these numbers are actually not comparable.
How do you assign these to the first half of your code,
No. So this 0.03 is not the SNP density per kilobase, but it's 0.03 out of 384 SNPs. So let me show you in a second. So this is relative. These numbers are actually not comparable, 0.03 versus 0.04. Yeah?
I see on the left plot, you could put the background frequency of the right, just for us to see if anything beyond position number A is more conserved than you expected by pure chance or about, you know, random.
Yes, so pure chance should be around here.
So it's basically everything beyond the kernel is, you know, as conserved as you expect by pure chance. So it's
roughly, yes. That's right. And actually, let me just give you the number because that'll make things easy. Oh, okay. So I'm not going to get to that for another couple of slides, but in these in conserved control sequences, the SNP density, which I think you're asking about, is about 0.75 per kilobase. And over here, it's about 0.5 per kilobase. I'm just talking now about the seed part. So that's a reduction of about a third in SNP density versus other conserved sequences. So it's a tough control because those other conserved sequences are very likely functional in their own right. If you look against the genome background, I said there's roughly one SNP per kilobase. And here we see half a SNP per kilobase. So that's about a twofold difference. Okay, so this is just SNP density, and it's highly suggestive of selection on this part of the binding site, yeah.
One question. We look closer to these targets that have a SNP on the nucleus.
Right.
So could you see that they have something in common? Maybe there are some microRNA genes that have a ratio that is not so good, and that would be not that critical?
We didn't, actually. But we probably should. Okay. So this is SNP density analysis, and it's certainly suggestive of selection. But to make this more rigorous, we have to go into a slight detour into population genetics, but a very slight detour. So we associate with each SNP allele a selection coefficient. So this is a standard assumption, S. The way to interpret S is that the expected number of progeny for somebody with that allele in the next generation would be 1 plus S relative to sort of the average genotype. If S is less than 0, then we call that negative selection. S is equal to 0, that's neutral. And S greater than 0 is positive selection. So those are alleles which are being selected to be fixed in the population. And just to give you an idea of what the magnitude of S is, here's an example from the human literature. This is actually the highest selection coefficient that I'm aware of, which is about 0.1. And this is for the European lactase allele. So this is the gene which allows you to actually digest lactose. And you see that actually S can be very small, and that can be that can have a lot of effect on evolutionary timescales. Sorry?
It's certainly small because
S
means that you have 10% more children, right? Or
yeah. So actually, it's but this is really the highest by far. Of anything that's known. Okay, and then that's right. I'm just saying not to expect 10. Yeah. So one more slide just about a quick overview of population genetics. So this is a neutral theory which is most closely associated with this guy, but he's obviously not the only person who thought about this. King and Jukes are some other prominent names. Most mutations that you see in the genome are deleterious and therefore under negative selection. It comes as no surprise to people who do genetics. Most observed polymorphisms, however, that you see in the population are actually neutral or nearly neutral. And then positive selection is considered to be very rare, or at least tough to detect. So that's the picture which one would expect. And here, what I'm showing is just the allele frequency of a single SNP over time. So time is on this axis, the allele frequency is here. It goes from 0% to 100%. So 0% means it's at very low levels. 100% means it's actually fixed in the population. This is a neutral SNP, so there's no selection here at all. And you see that there is just this random fluctuation which happens just because of demographic, just because of random sampling, basically. And you see here that this SNP is hanging around this low regime near zero a lot of the time, and then eventually, just by chance, it kind of takes off, and eventually it fixes, and it'll be there for forever until a new mutation occurs. But the point here is that even under neutral evolution, you don't expect this SNP to be hanging out here around 50% for a lot of its evolution. You expect it to be down around zero for most of the time. If you have selection, positive selection would send the allele frequency higher, would tend to bias it higher towards 100%. Negative selection would tend to bias it lower towards 0%. And you can You can observe how that looks here by now looking at the derived allele frequency distribution. So for S equals zero, which is neutral evolution, you see that it has this, the curve has this shape. So these are now theoretical simulations. And you see that most of the time it is very low frequency. And as you increase the selection coefficient, the magnitude of the selection coefficient, so it becomes more and more negative, you see that the allele tends to spend more time close to zero. And you see that these are much smaller numbers than the lactase selection coefficient, which I was talking about before, but this has a very, very big effect on the skew of the distribution. So here I've actually switched on you slightly. Before I was talking about the time that a single allele spends in one particular part of the allele frequency spectrum. Now I've switched this to talking about a distribution of alleles. So these are a collection of alleles which are all evolving under the same process, but now independently. And this is the distribution of their allele frequencies, which is just the same, actually, as the single allele case.
So what is the effect of population size of this picture? So where is the threshold of the crossover from
So these simulations are simply for human population size of 10,000. So 1 over 10,000 would be the threshold.
The second one would be basically
still
Yes. Yes. Simulations,
no, these are Poisson random field simulations, so it's constant population size, independently evolving SNPs.
But then it's even non-analytic.
Right, okay, so it's not really a simulation, this is actually an analytical calculation. Okay. So this is negative selection, and you see that the distribution gets skewed more and more towards low alleles, low frequency alleles. Here's the analogous picture, but now for positive selection. So again, S, this blue bar is neutral evolution, and it has the same curve as you saw before. And as you increase the positive selection, it starts to go and be skewed more towards high frequency alleles. So this is kind of data which we want to do, and the way we actually do this in practice is we have to decide which is the derived allele. When you have a human SNP, you have two alleles. We have to decide which one is derived, which one is ancestral. We always call the ancestral one the one which is the same as the chimp allele, and you can do this for 98% of the SNPs. That the chimp allele will be equal to one of the other two. It's also just known from both empirical data and from theoretical calculations that the chimp allele is almost always going to be the correct ancestral allele, in this particular case, for human and chimp divergence. And so the derived allele is the other human allele. And now given a set of SNPs, we can compute this derived allele frequency distribution and see what it looks like. And the point here, which is the most important point to get out of this sort of this foray into population genetics, is that an excess of rare derived alleles is a signature of negative selection. Right? So more skew towards the left is a signature of negative selection. Yeah.
Are you saying that there are less mutations on the chimp branch?
I'm saying that the way the mutation rate works out, you're likely to only get one mutation on either the human or the chimp branch. It's very unlikely that you would get mutations on both of these branches. So if you see that the human branch has mutated, then it's almost sure that the shrimp branch has not mutated.
But if you're looking only at the... But isn't that a question of priority? If you look at the, those humans which have mutated, mm-hmm. the chance that the chimp has also mutated should be the same again as for any chimp. I mean, the effect is going to be very much only 1%, less than 1%.
Right.
But I think that's a question. If you switch priors and only look at those which have mutated, which are the ones interesting for your analysis, mm-hmm. then you're back to the same distribution again.
Okay.
But I think it's still.
But those are still very. That's still a very small probability.
Yeah,
and there are actually lots of SNPs which were sequenced in chimp. So not only this chimp sequencing project, but also they shotgun sequenced some wild populations as well. And to first approximation, the chimp SNPs and the human SNPs don't fall on the same basis. So this seems to be a very good approximation. Okay, so here is an example from the literature, which is similar to what Shamil Tunayev was talking about earlier. This is actually from a paper by Drake et al. And here, all they did was they looked at conserved regions in the genome versus non-conserved regions in the genome. The gray is the conserved regions. Gray is non-conserved. Black is conserved. And what you see is that the black SNPs are skewed towards the left. And so what they've shown here is that there is negative selection on these conserved regions. Okay. It's not completely trivial, as you might be wondering, because it's also possible that the conserved regions have lower mutation rates. And this shows that actually it's selection going on. Okay, so here's our data. So the important thing here is the distribution in red over here, which are the conserved microRNA binding sites, and everything else here are controls. Okay, so over here in blue are the synonymous sites. So these are SNPs in protein coding regions which do not change the amino acid. We expect those to be neutral, and they pretty much follow the neutral expectation from the plots I showed before. Over here in purple are 3' UTRs, so we do see selection on 3' UTRs relative to synonymous sites. Over here are conserved 3' UTRs, so this is slightly surprising, but conservation in 3' UTRs, here we've removed the microRNA binding sites. So conservation in 3' UTRs does not really buy you very much unless you're a microRNA binding site. This is consistent as well with sort of the scatter plots which I showed before that showed that most of the conservation in binding sites in 3' UTRs is due to microRNAs.
As long as you consider sharp motifs, right?
Right. So these conserved 3' UTRs are sharp. There's no degeneracy allowed in this conservation over here. Non-synonymous sites, these traditionally are the things which people look for when they look for functional sites. These are things in protein coding regions which change the amino acids, so you'd expect them to have some function. And we do see a lot more selection on these sites compared to the controls. But now for conserved microRNA sites, we see a much larger signature of negative selection, even compared to non-synonymous sites. And if you're wondering, the explanation for this probably is that the non-synonymous sites, we do not look for conserved conservation over here. So quite possibly, if you would do that and look for conserved non-synonymous sites and put another bar up here, it would be even higher. This is what we see. And if you compare this distribution, we just compare them with a Mann-Whitney test, a rank test. You see that this distribution is significantly more skewed towards low-frequency alleles compared to all these other ones. Okay, so the data I'm showing you here is just for Europeans, and it's just for the HapMap data, but it's actually an identical story. All the numbers, yeah, so and same for the others.
How are these SNPs location in genome?
What is the typical SNP?
Yeah, so there are very few SNPs in here.
Yeah.
So I think they're completely unlinked. I haven't specifically looked at that.
They are completely unlinked. I mean, if you're talking about the ones which I'm concerned by insights.
Yes, you looked at that. Okay.
So it's like more than 100 KB.
Well, there's only 100 or so sites in here, 100 or so SNPs in here, and it's a 3 billion base genome. So it should be on the order of megabases. Right, so there's very few SNPs in here. There's not a lot of data to work with. But everything is statistically significant. So here's what we see. This derived allele frequency distribution does suggest greater negative selection on the microRNA sites, conserved microRNA sites, compared even to other conserved 3' UTR sites, right? So these other things could be sites for proteins, so they could even be sites for microRNAs which are not discovered yet, but we see greater negative selection even compared to those. Now, there are some possible caveats not related to selection, and this is more specific to population genetics, but let me just discuss them briefly. So it's also possible that you could get the skew from demography, ascertainment bias. So this is now very specific to these genotyping projects, because they're looking for medically interesting SNPs, so they're looking actually specifically for the ones which have higher allele frequencies in the population, and that therefore skews the distribution. It's also possible hitchhiking and background selection. So this would be like the SNP is not actually being selected, but it's very close to another SNP, say in the protein coding region, which is under selection. And those two things, because of the lack of recombination between these two SNPs, tend to move together in tandem. And there's also linkage, which is what Villa just brought up. And I don't actually think that any of these things really could be the explanation. The reason for that is because we have interspersed sites. So things we're comparing to are randomly distributed with respect to the things we care about, right? So these conserved 3' UTR sites. And so we would expect that most of these things should affect both of those classes roughly equally. And here are the SNP density numbers, which you asked about before, and here they are. Okay, so now we went from this, which was just comparing different sites, and now we wanted to actually ask questions about what percentage of these sites are actually functional, and what percentage of them are actually just false positives. And to do this, we have a nice sort of population genetics trick again. So here's the same plot I showed you before. It turns out, as Michael was pointing out, that you can actually write down analytically what this, what the density function is for the SNP to be in this infinitesimal interval of allele frequency. And you can do this even under selection. Okay. So that's what I'm saying here. So this goes under the name the Poisson random field model, or some people call it the infinite sites model. But essentially, you can write down this density function for the amount of time that the allele with a specific selection coefficient S spends in that interval. That same mathematics translates over to the case where you have lots of different independently evolving SNPs. And so the number of those SNPs which are in a particular interval at a given time point, a slice in time, is again this density function FS. And the way we want to use this is, given the allele frequency distribution which we can actually observe, we're going to use some kind of maximum likelihood approach to compute what the likely selection coefficient was which produced this Fourier frequency distribution. So we want to extend this slightly further. So this is slightly similar to what Shamil Sunayag was talking about earlier. We assume that there are two classes of microRNA sites. There's the real ones. We assume that these are under negative selection and that they all have the same selection coefficient. We assume that the others are all false positive predictions, and therefore those are all just evolving neutrally. Okay. So you can extend the mathematics from the previous slide to this case of just a mixture of these two different classes with two different selection coefficients, one of which is negative, one of which is zero. This is a simple model, but we use formal likelihood ratio tests to show that this model actually fits the data better than just having a one-class model where you just have every site evolving under the same selection coefficient, or a three-class model, which is where you would have also a class of sites which are under positive selection. And to implement this, we had to account for ascertainment bias, so we used only uniformly ascertained PearlGen SNPs. So this is going back to where I said PearlGen has some nice properties, and in this case, they actually completely resequenced about 40 individuals. And so we use just those SNPs to do this inference. This approach also assumes several things, and let me just state those assumptions explicitly. So one is we assume that there are no lethal mutations in microRNA binding sites. And we think that this is pretty much okay based on what we know about knockouts of these microRNA binding sites from the literature. We also have to assume that evolution between SNPs is independent. And this goes back to the linkage question, which Villa brought up. If they're evolving very far from each other, it's likely that there's a lot of recombination between them, and then actually this independent evolution assumption is pretty good. Okay. So if you go through this whole machinery, here's the number that pops out. It's 85%, which is very high. But I don't want to make such a big deal out of this number because we do have a caveat here in that we did not model demography. So it's actually quite a non-trivial problem mathematically to infer both demography and selection at the same time within this framework. And so we made the usual assumption that the population size is constant. It's known that if the population size is expanding, which is likely to be the case for the human population, then actually you can also get these some bias towards low frequency alleles. And so this is future work, but nonetheless, with the assumptions that we have, this is the number that we get out. Okay, so the nice thing about all this machinery is that it doesn't require conserved microRNA binding sites. So I said before that we really have no idea at this point how many of these non-conserved sites are actually functional. So here's the same plot as before, but now I'm looking not at conserved microRNA binding sites, just at the non-conserved ones and the co-expressed ones. So here in blue is the synonymous control. That should be neutral. 3' UTRs are another control. Non-conserved sites, so we see essentially no difference between non-conserved sites and 3' UTRs. So that's saying that if you don't use any expression data at all, and you just try to look for non-conserved sites in the genome, you get no signal whatsoever, which is probably not unexpected. Now, if you do use the expression data and you look at these co-expressed sites, which remember are non-conserved sites which are expressed in the same tissue, at least as the microRNA, you can divide those into the ones which are being lost in humans and the ones which are being gained in humans based on the chimp outgroup. You see that we do see here some negative selection on co-expressed sites. It's close to it's sort of marginally significant, but it is significant. And we see a non-significant signature of negative selection on these gained co-expressed sites. So a lost co-expressed site, this would be something like a co-expressed site where it's bad for you to lose this in humans. Gained co-expressed site, that would be something where it's bad for you to gain a site in humans, because then you would be regulated by the microRNA. So it's slightly curious why we can see a signature for negative selection for one but not the other. But it is possible that the reason for this is just this operational definition I talked about before of non-conserved sites. We said before that a site could be actually evolutionarily conserved. We just don't detect it as such because of alignment errors, or possibly because of genomic rearrangements, or possibly because the target model is simply insufficient and those sites are real, but we just don't detect them with the seed model. So that could be one possible reason for this discrepancy between the non-conserved and lost and gained. The same caveat of demography applies before to the PRF model as applied to calculating the number of functional non-conserved sites. But nonetheless, here's the number that we pull out with assuming a constant population size. How are we doing on time? Should we
speed up?
We should speed up. Okay, so I'm going to skip the technical points of this. I'll just say that we looked for recent local selections. So far I haven't used at all the differences between the different populations of humans. So between, for instance, Europeans and Asians and Africans. We compute the statistic FST, which is just a measure of the differentiation between these populations. We expect FST to fluctuate randomly across the genome. However, unusually high FST can suggest recent local selection. Here are the technical details, which I'm going to skip. We looked for SNPs which have very high FST, and we found exactly one. This SNP happens to be in a conserved binding site of this microRNA, and it happens to be in this gene. The interesting thing about this is that post-transcriptional misregulation of this gene has already been implicated previously in these diseases, and it has very high FST, meaning it has very high population differentiation between these different populations, as you see here. So we haven't actually shown experimentally that this SNP has anything to do with these diseases, but it's an interesting SNP to look at nonetheless. So here's a summary of this part of the talk. I said before that there were three motivations for looking at SNPs and secretory sites. The medical one, we have one interesting candidate. We haven't actually shown that we haven't really shown that this SNP has anything to do with these diseases. However, I think what we have shown is that SNPs in microRNA sites are very good candidates for looking at in disease mapping studies. On the bioinformatics applications, we've predicted non-conserved microRNA sites, I think, for the first time, and also these techniques where you can predict sites and then test them using these population genetic methods without having to use conservation can actually be generalized to other types of secretory elements, such as transcription vector binding sites, and we're interested in looking at that. And finally, with the evolution, we've, I think, for the first time, made an explicit explicit connection between microRNAs and fitness. We can actually put a number on that.
Kevin,
yeah.
The last point there. So, if you were able to put a hollow bound for the selection in the sense that what would be the fraction of
base
positive false positives versus your true predictions?
Lower bound based on what? Based on demography?
No, just doing your maximum likelihood analysis. So, what were the actual values for the.
On the selection coefficient? Yeah, so it was in the range of minus 10. It's 2NS, but it's not something which I'm really, I think is that meaningful because it's an average argument, sort of. We're not actually considering the distribution of selection coefficients over the functional sites, but just looking at the average. So it's not something which I talk about a lot, yeah.
How
how significant is it? I mean,
how significant is the maximum likelihood? Well, that it's different from zero?
That it's, you know, like, if you say that something of the order of minus 10, is it the...
Is it significantly different from zero? Yeah, so we didn't, I guess, do that explicitly, but we did fit also a neutral model. As I said, we did likelihood ratio tests, and that was significant in a chi-square test. So I think that a completely neutral model has been rejected. Is that what you're asking? That's essentially what you're asking, right? And that was very, very significant. Okay, so I'm just going to end by reminding you that we're not only interested in this part of gene regulation, which is post-transcriptional, but also in this transcriptional control, and that there are transcription factor binding sites which are interesting at the 5' end of these genes. This slide comes from a very ambitious review article which Nikolaos and I wrote, which tries to compare transcriptional and post-transcriptional regulation in an evolutionary sense. So just very briefly, some of the things which we think we see are there are lots of similarities between these two types of gene regulation, particularly this story about rapid turnover of cis-regulatory sites versus a slower evolution of transfactors. Also lots of lineage-specific expansions of transfactor families. However, we do see a lot of significant differences. So I think one of the significant ones is that microRNA binding sites, because they're exact sites, are probably easier to lose by mutation than transcription factor binding sites, and vice versa, TF binding sites are easier to gain. So this could mean something for the relative evolution of these two regulatory systems. Here's an interesting one. In that animals seem to have gained lots of new microRNA binding site families, new microRNA families, whereas the number of new TF families seems to be very small. And also, going back to the story from Davidson, where the structure of developmental networks influences the rate of evolution of these different gene regulatory mechanisms, the position of microRNAs and transcription factors within these developmental networks has a large impact on the rate of evolution. Yes?
So the exact equivalent of your observation that the kernel is strictly conserved from flight in human would be, if you want to translate it to transcriptional regulatory networks, that would be as if you had some transcriptional factor which targets a lot of, some big transcriptional hub.
Yes.
Then you would predict that, if the analogy would be perfect, then you'd predict that DNA binding domain would not evolve at all. There would be no substitutions in DNA.
Right. And that's difficult to do on a genome-wide scale for transcription factor binding sites right now, because we just don't have really good predictions for this?
No, talking about the motif, but rather that if you compare autologous transcription factors in different genomes, we see a usually high level of conservation of DNA binding motif in them, of DNA binding delay in transcription factors. I don't know if somebody did it or is this.
If you see, I think that's what you're asking, right? If the motif is.
I use the word motif, but what I get is the DNA binding domain. It's just the line and elastic sequences of the transcription factors in different genomes.
Yeah.
And if you see that they perfectly match, that would be equivalent to your observation that microRNA perfectly matches between fly and human.
Right. So, and I think that's true, actually, right? Do you agree? Like, for a lot of transcription factor families, that the DNA binding domain is at the amino acid level pretty much conserved.
Well, still, there are a lot of substitutions.
But I thought your specific question was if the rate of conservation is correlated with the hubness.
Yeah, precisely. Yeah.
Oh, okay.
Right.
And that I don't think we know the answer to at this point.
Well, in bacteria, there's something of a wacky correlation.
It goes in the right direction.
Yeah.
Right. Okay.
Yeah. But why is it that
Okay, so yeah, so the argument here is simply that the transcription factor binding site is fuzzy, and so it's possible to acquire a weak binding site by point mutation, whereas in the microRNA site, because it appears to be an exact 7-mer required, that you might need a lot of mutations to get actually to a microRNA binding site.
And many transcription factor binding sites are longer than 7. I mean, the length is also...
Right, so it's not an exact... Yeah.
I mean, it all depends on the length.
Uh-huh. Right. Yes, so all of these things are complications to this cartoon, which I've just... what I really should have said here is that perfect binding sites are easier to lose, but but non-degenerate. But degenerate binding sites are easier to gain. Yeah.
Because
okay.
This easier to gain and easier to lose refers to whether there is some non-equilibrium, whether sort of something moves towards gaining or moves towards losing. But whatever the fuzziness is, the question of whether there's equilibrium between loss and gain, or there's an easier loss and gain, is disjoint.
I'm not sure I understand. But this is for a specific binding site. It's not for the regulatory region of an entire gene.
Yeah, but even for a specific binding site. So if you say, whatever you choose as your target, you know, your fuzziness allows, that you can then say it's an equilibrium of loss and gain over that threshold, or there's an excess of loss, or there's an easier gain. I don't think it's that argument's radius and the question of...
No, but okay, so this is, I think, your... for example, we cite your paper, in which which shows that if you acquire weak binding, that you might have adaptive evolution, which could push you towards strong binding, right? If I understood correctly, what you guys were talking about. Whereas if the binding is binary, like it appears to be in a microRNA binding site, you don't have actually this adaptive evolution, right? One cannot do anything with a partial microRNA binding site, at least in this cartoon sketch. One could possibly do something with a partial TF binding site, fuzzy one. Okay. And I'm just going to end here with an ambitious model, which we described in this paper, which shows how, if a microRNA has so many targets, how can it ever evolve? Whereas we seem to see lots of new microRNAs popping up in animal evolution. So what we've proposed here is that really microRNAs are random bits of hairpin-like sequences in the genome which are randomly transcribed. So here I'm claiming that a transcription factor binding site is easy to gain, and so it might be easier to gain a promoter, a weak promoter of a random hairpin, and then you might be able to get small quantities of transcription of these microRNAs, which would then have random targets in the genome. Okay, so and most of these would be deleterious, as you expect them to be deleterious. Some of them might be neutral or advantageous. You might want to keep them around. But over time, you can have selection which would purge these deleterious targets, so the total number of targets would go down, and as a fraction, these deleterious targets might be only a small fraction of the total number of targets, and at that point you can reinforce this expression of microRNAs and relax this restriction of low expression and low tissue specificity. And some of the corollaries of this are that new microRNAs should have lower expression level and that they should have more specific tissue expression patterns. And we do think we see that roughly in the microRNA data that we do have. The other corollary of this is that a lot of these new microRNAs, which might be at very low levels, might actually have rather low biological importance in regulating other genes in trans.
Yeah. My belief is that from the data, there's actually very good evidence for what you just said, that it's roughly, i.e., that new microRNAs are lonely.
Okay.
scientifically, but I think that's really true. If you look at the data, you really see that.
So I think this point is maybe not so controversial in the other ones.
Okay. So one last slide, which is I think population genetics of cis regulatory sites is going to be a very interesting thing to do in the future, especially as we have very cheap genome sequencing. And with that, I'm just going to say thanks and acknowledge Nicholas Rajewski, with whom I did all of this work at NYU, and also just the members of the Rajewski, Piano, Gonzalez, and Siegel labs at NYU for their moral support. Okay.
You know, some of in animal systems, some of the microRNAs have multiple sites in the 3' UTR.
That's right.
And did you look at that at all? And do you think it would have any impact on the
on the analysis?
You know, like some of the non-conserved versus the conserved, because you would think that, you know, if you had one site versus multiple, that
right,
would
right, it would change the selection. Yeah, we did look at that, and it doesn't seem to make much of a difference here. So if you throw out all the, if you have redundant sites in the genome and you throw them out, it doesn't seem to change these selection plots. Yes?
If the expression of the microRNAs correlate with when did they appear, could we see also a correlation of the clusters, that we see in the clusters? Because whatever is in a cluster is expressed together.
Probably, yes. So, yeah, we haven't looked at that. But probably should. Yeah. Okay.
So this model, this evolutionary model, which you had on the previous slide, can I just a couple more questions about it?
Yeah.
Could you go back one slide?
This is the slide.
Yeah, this slide, right. So basically, if this is how it works, then we expect the very new microRNAs, which are not yet highly selected for, to be more hubby than others. So it kind of goes against the intuition of
that
for people that hubs are important, so to say.
No, so hubby in the sense that they would have a lot of random targets,
right?
But those shouldn't be conserved, right?
Well, again, you know, but if you just do it, but I want to say is that it's kind of interesting observation and that it could be experimentally verified, or I want to, Nicolaus, you said that you have some experimental indication that indeed the new ones are targeted more, or?
Well, no, so I didn't say anything about the target, I just talked about the expression.
Ah, okay, that they are expressed at low levels.
Yeah, right.
Right, but I think your question is maybe answered by the conservation of the targets.
And the big difference really is that microRNA can kind of evolve de novo, whereas transcription factors only evolve by duplications.
Yes. Right.
So that's the principal difference.
Right.
But there is just one question, not a couple of questions.
Well, it wasn't a question, but I just wanted to make sure that I.
You have these 384 SNPs in.
Right.
In target sites,
right.
How many would you expect if SNPs were randomly sprinkled across the genome? And if you got more, wouldn't that already be an indication of negative selection?
No, I don't think so, because we do get more at random, but I think the problem with that argument is the mutation rates, and this depends on sequence composition, right? For example, CpGs.
Right, but that you could also factor into your expectation value.
Yeah, you could, but I think it's a difficult thing to actually. I think it's difficult to actually tease out these exact sequence-dependent mutation rates. I mean, you can of course just fit, two neighbors on the side if you want, but I don't know if that really gets to the heart of the question. I think the divided with frequencies costs are much more direct.
And you put the CpG dependence into the allele model.
No, we did not.
But that would also have to do by the same.
That also has a problem. Yes, but we just essentially discarded the top bin for this analysis.
So.
further questions? Thank you.